The Defense Department has a Byzantine process that's meant to ensure it only acquires what it really needs. But there's no comparable set of guardrails to make sure it doesn't get rid of things it does need. That's one conclusion of auditors at the Government Accountability Office. They fault the Air Force for not doing enough homework before it proposed to get rid of the A-10 fighter. John Pendleton is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at GAO. He tells Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu the Air Force didn't adequately account for all the missions the A-10 performs before it decided to ground it.
That really is the most important question here. There will be a bit of a lag there, assuming the F-35 comes on. But everyone, let's talk a little bit about what the A-10 is and what all it does. I mean, it's iconic, right? It's a flying tank. It has the Gatling gun in the front. It's beloved by the many ground troops that it's supported in combat. And everyone knows it for the close air support that it does. But with precision-guided munitions and unmanned systems, we can drop bombs from bombers now and support ground troops and from UASs, and we got different ways to perform CAS, and that's what everyone is focused on, but the A-10 does more, and the CAS community that supports it does more, like combat search and rescue. When a pilot is down, the A-10 pilots and the aircraft are the ones that typically coordinate the rescue mission, and they provide cover for the rescue helicopters that would come in, and it's not clear how the Air Force will perform this mission even after they get the F-35. And then there's the issue of the fact that the CAS pilots focus on these missions, right? That, I mean, compared to an F-16 pilot or an F-35 pilot, an A-10 pilot does 22 close air support sorties in a year to be qualified, where an F-16 pilot does maybe 12 because they're training lots of other missions. So the idea that the multi-role fighters will fill in all the gaps, I'm just not sure that's right.
Yeah, and I want to talk about specific capabilities a little bit more in a minute, but I think more fundamentally, no one knows the full extent of the capability gaps because the Air Force doesn't really have a process for coming up with a baseline for what its overall fighter requirements are. Is that fair?
No, that really is an issue. It was an issue for us here because, you know, GAO likes its criteria. We don't want to just make up things. We want to look and see what the rules are, and requirements very often set the foundation for a program. And we really found that the Air Force doesn't have clearly stated capacity requirements for close air support or the other missions that the A-10 does. It sounds like a simple question, how much do you need? But apparently it's not a simple answer. And the lack of such requirements makes it really difficult to evaluate the impact of any shortfall.
And not just requirements for close air support, but requirements or any kind of process for evaluating requirements in light of any kind of divestment decision.
Well, how are you going to mitigate the impact is the main question, right? I mean, it's like, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And what we were hoping to see is detailed analysis about how you would do CSAR Sandy or Forward Air Control Airborne, which is another mission that the department does, or the fast attack, against swarm boats. And we just didn't see the detailed analysis that we were hoping for, even on the classified side.
And it seems like one of the issues that you guys were getting at is some of those secondary missions have been maybe even being neglected in the training environment because there's been such a focus on the close air support capabilities of the A-10.
I think that that is possibly true, but we were more concerned that it wasn't clear to us how we would do some of the things even after we got the F-35 in. The Air Force has stood up some integration groups and things to study that, which I think is sort of a tacit acceptance that some work needs to be done, which is a step in the right direction. But it just wasn't clear to us how they were going to meet these other missions.
How much does the decision to push the A-10 retirement proposal a little further into the out years mitigate some of these capability gaps to the extent that we understand the capability gaps?
Oh, I think it, again, we couldn't do that analysis because you don't have the requirements to give you a precise answer, but the A-10 is the best at many of these things. I mean, it just absolutely is, and A-10 pilots are the ones that really focus on this, the doctors of CAS, they've been called. And by CAS, they mean the things like combat search and rescue, Sandy. It's a catch-all term that means all the things that these A-10 pilots and squadrons do.
Getting back to one of the issues that you mentioned before, just the topic of the Air Force simply not having a good methodology for thinking about requirements that are going to go unfilled if it decides to divest something. How big a problem is that? To what extent is that a DoD-wide problem, I guess, is my question.
I think that really is the heart of the issue, if you step back from just the A-10. I mean, the department has a lot of aging things, and there's going to be more and more decision points where they have to decide at what point to let go of the old stuff to make room for the newer, more capable stuff. And especially if you're still using the old stuff a lot. You know, like I said, we like our criteria at GAO, and we had a problem from the get-go here on this because there's no specific rules for divesting multi-million dollar platforms. I mean, everyone's aware that it takes several acts of Congress to buy something, to acquire something. And lots of laws and regulations, and but the services, by contrast, can decide to divest something as part of a budget drill, which is what happened here. The Air Force didn't really want to let go of the A-10; they just didn't have enough money. They couldn't make it fit in the palm.
Sure.
And we saw something similar a couple of years back on with the Navy when the Navy proposed to retire early some cruisers and dock landing ships. And that was another case where Congress stopped them because they just didn't feel like they'd adequately made their case. So we stepped back and we made a broader recommendation here that basically said, DOD, we think you ought to put some guidance out about, you know, the kinds of things you want to consider in these divestment proposals, because it made it difficult for us to evaluate, and it leaves the services a little bit vulnerable when people ask questions. I mean, Oh, it's an oversimplification, but, you know, we have acquisition rules so we don't buy things we don't need. Our argument is we need clear divestment rules so we don't get rid of stuff that we do need. And again, I'm not trying to describe a Byzantine process on the other side that equals the acquisition process. but not having any guidance, I'm not sure is acceptable either.
You mentioned that you noticed this with the Navy program a couple years ago, but as far as the absence of that process around divestment, is that something that GAO has been concerned about in a broader context before, or did this A-10 study really bring that to light?
Well, in my portfolio, you know, I look at force structure and readiness issues, not so much the acquisition side. And so when we got to this point, we started conferring with our folks that do acquisition and started looking at sort of where the department was with a lot of its systems. And again, this capacity, the notion that we need a lot of stuff now and that a lot of it is aging versus, you know, capability, buying new stuff, we started looking, this is going to keep coming up. And so we thought it made sense for us to sort of put this mark in the ground and say, DOD, maybe you ought to think about setting some rules for this to keep from these things from getting sort of pushed back at you from the Congress. The department did not agree. They do not want to do that. They not concur with that recommendation.
Right. As you said earlier, this was a budget-driven decision. But as far as estimating the amount of money that you'd actually save by getting rid of the A-10, you also found the estimates the Air Force had been giving Congress weren't credible, or at least didn't meet best practices for being credible, if there's a meaningful difference between those things. Tell us why.
Yeah, I mean, I could go down that rabbit hole pretty far, but I'll save you from that. We have various aspects we look at in cost estimates, but what they did was pretty simple. They had a bunch of Air Force leaders together, and they looked at various missions, and they said, okay, we've been told to prioritize modernization, and let's look at the cost of all these various missions. And the A-10, you know, in a situation where you're prioritizing modernization, it's nearly 40 years old, many of them, it didn't fare real well. And so they said, well, how much can we save? And what the Air Force did was go into its program, the Future Years Defense Program, and say, how much is in there for the A-10? And that's fine for a broad brush sense of savings, but it left things out. You know, there are things you might have to do if you don't have the A-10 that weren't part of that cost estimate. And it could have overstated or understated how much you would save. So it doesn't give you the kind of fidelity that you need for, you know, to really identify how much you'd save. It's probably in the ballpark, but there'd be costs that probably were not contemplated, and there may be additional savings that weren't contemplated.
And obviously you can't take all of that money out of the FYDP, because one of the things that they've been arguing for is to take their existing A-10 maintainers and move them to the F-35. So that alone is probably a fairly big expense.
Absolutely. I mean, the Air Force has got an in-strength challenge as well. And they're short maintainers already. They'd already started making some of these changes. So sometimes the savings, as you know, in the government is actually a transfer But the Air Force is quite short on maintainers. Absolutely.
Back to your recommendations. You mentioned earlier that one of the key ones had been kicked to the curb. Any you feel like you've made any headway in convincing either the Air Force or larger DOD about what needs to be done here?
Despite the Air Force not concur with our contention that they needed more information should they bring back this proposal to divest the A-10 to really walk through some of the issues that I've described here. The Air Force responded that they felt they had done that and that their analysis, and I'm quoting here because I think it's important for the listeners to hear this. The Air Force said the A-10 divestment was the most acceptable strategy to remain within Air Force budget authority while controlling risk across all mission sets. And by all, they mean Air Force mission sets primarily. And that may very well be true for the Air Force, but that we're not sure that it was necessarily true for across the department. Now, having their non-concurrence notwithstanding, they're doing some things that we mention in the report. Again, they have an integration group. They're talking about how they would meet some of the gaps that are being identified, but we just didn't have enough to go on yet about whether or not those would actually follow through. So despite their non-concurrence, they're actually doing some things that are steps in the right direction.
John Pendleton, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at GAO, speaking with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends.